Hello, this is Richard Thompson, and welcome to the Mojo Record Club.
Hello, I'm Andrew Mayle, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. Now, before I introduce this week's guest, I should probably say that the Mojo Record Club will sound a little different moving forward. Same content, but split into two parts. We hope it'll make listening through just a little more enjoyable and accessible. Two easily digestible sections instead of one epic listen. Okay. My guest today are Mojo editor John Mulvey and the great Richard Thompson. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks, Andrew.
Raised in North London's Muswell Hill in the 1950s, Richard Thompson was a shy, introverted kid with a pronounced stutter who spoke through his guitar. His father, a Dumfries Presbyterian who worked as a Scotland Yard detective, gave him two significant gifts, or maybe this is three, a love of Django Reinhardt and Scottish folk music and the gimlet eye of the Secret Observer. With those gifts and a voice of warm, mournful beauty, Thompson has given us nearly 60 years of incredible music with Fairport Convention and then his then wife, Linda Thompson, and 19 solo albums, creating a stunning repertoire of songs that mix Celtic, African, and Appalachian rhythms, and in his own words, catalogue, quote, the grittier, darker things, demons, things that haunt you, solutions to your own questions about life. Luckily for us, he has a new album out at the end of May, his 20th, The Magnificent Ship to Shore, which fans will be delighted to hear, deals with the usual themes of fate, darkness, silver-tongued heels, false hope, turnstile Casanovas, and doomed romance. Here is the first track taken from the album, a current live favourite, I believe, and a paean to mystical love. This is Singapore Sadie, written by Richard Thompson, and released on New West Records.
Poor singer, poor Sadie, she channels the dead like they're standing right there in the room. She can be forgiving at times to the living, so please number me in that crew. She don't dignify one of her chicks or beginners. She don't hang around with no rock and toss winners.
Richard, this new album is wonderful, and Singapore Sadie feels very much in keeping with, I think, one of what appeared to my ears as one of the themes of the album on tracks like Maybe, Trust, and The Day That I Give In, where love is a kind of doomed madness or a spell often cast by scary and formidable women, femme fatales. What are we to make of this?
What am I to make of it? Crikey. Well, there's a few jokes on there as well. I mean, let's not get
absolutely
burdened with the heavier side of things. Well, you know, I think you can write a love song, you know, that says, you know, I love you, basically. You know, you're great. I love you. Let's get married and set, you know, traditional sentimental love song. On the other hand, I think you can go a bit deeper than that, and you can treat love a bit more seriously, because it is more serious and it's more complicated, you know. And I think, if anything, the songs that I write about love are just complicated love. You know, I think sometimes you love people in spite of things, you know, in spite of their faults, you love them anyway. Sometimes you can't always get what you want. Oh, there's a song title for you. you know, there's, you know, it's an obstacle race sometimes. And
yes,
there is a lot to deal with. So I just try to reflect that in songs. And I'm sorry if it all gets too complicated.
Not at all. This is speaking very much as a fan and speaking to the fans who kind of, you know, I think come to your songs for exactly that. You know, looking for that extra strange detail, looking beyond the prosaic, looking beyond the normal, and also kind of looking beyond kind of the beauty or the wondrous to see kind of those little kind of specks of strangeness and darkness in there.
Well, hooray for that, is all I can say. I mean, who do we blame? Dylan for you know, persuading the Beatles to write something a bit more complicated, you know, a bit more realistic, maybe. You know, popular music used to be much more straightforward. And I'm sorry to be one of those people who kind of muddies the waters, you know, on the lake of love.
But also, I think, you know, very much that the thing we were saying about the kind of the very early education in the folk song and the kind of the traditional folk song where love is very much a kind of a muddied lake, you know, often muddied by the, you know, the blood of drowned kind of lovers and lady and lords and ladies and things like that. So growing up with that sense that, you know, the bright, you know, the rose and the thorn.
The rose and the thorn. I mean, that kind of sums up the love song in traditional music, I think, really. You know, a song like The Seeds of Love, where, you know, you're the suitor, but the girl's father is won't allow you to marry. And as you say, you know, there are things like, you know, Sir Patrick Spence Matty Groves or something, which is like a, you know, bloodbath of lust, a bloodbath of lust. It's like a headline in the Sun, really, isn't it? You know,
I'm making notes for the show notes already, so we'll put them all in the description. Yeah.
One of the other themes of the album, and you're right, there are jokes on there as well. But one of the other themes of the album, as you sing on one of my favorite tracks, The Old Pack Mule, is Hard Times and Hungry Times. And I wonder, is the current parlous state of the world rich pickings for a songwriter such as yourself?
I suppose so. I mean, it hasn't really changed, I don't think. Or it goes in cycles. I think it's fair to say it goes in cycles where there's a time for the overt political song.
Yeah.
And there's a time for the more subversive political song that's availed as something else, that's availed as a love song, or it's availed as a sociological song or something. You can say the world is increasingly full of despots at this point, or would-be despots. And that's scary. That's absolutely scary.
Yeah.
Is it scarier than, you know, World War II? Is it scarier than the bubonic plague? Well, probably not. But it's curious times that we live in, I should say.
And one of the again, another favorite on the album, Life's a Bloody Show, as well, seems very much rooted in the present. And how people kind of, you know, live, you know, sort of the less savory types seem to live their life at the moment.
Yeah, I think they've always been around. Sometimes the door opens a little bit and they can, rear their heads. I suppose in some aspects it's a Trumpian kind of figure in the song. And I wasn't really aiming for that. I thought Trump's a bit too easy a target in many ways. But the character in the song does have, Trumpian undertones and indeed overtones. it's just, you know, the sort of arrogant, you know, self-centered, you know, alpha male type, you know, of which I clearly am. you know, riding roughshod over everybody else. They've always been around, you know. Used to be Attila the Hun and or something, and now it's more, you know, there's various dictators around the world you could point at, perhaps we should work harder at preserving our democracy and our freedom.
Do you think that having such a thorough grounding in folk music gives you a long view of history, that it makes you more aware of these, of where events in our lifetime sit in relation to Attila the Hun or the bubonic plague?
I suppose generally, yes. I think it helps if you like history for history's sake as well. I do like history. I like reading about history. But if you love history, then I think you do love folk music because you think, oh, you know, this is a song from, you know, the 18th century. This is reflecting, you know, those sort of values. There's a song from, you know, maybe the 1500s. You know, it's interesting how how the forms can change, and but the subjects don't change that much as you go back through history. So it's good to have some perspective, and studying history really does do that for you, and gives you a clue about what's coming next. But only a clue, of course. But at least you know, forewarned is forearmed, as they say.
We're recording this on April the 4th, and you celebrated your 75th birthday yesterday. So happy birthday!
Well, thank you.
And how was it? What did you do?
Well, it was good. I had a huge argument to start the day, but that kind of simmered down by about, you know, 9 a.m. And then I got some nice presents. I got a very nice book on history, actually, and had dinner later with some friends from kind of New York, New Jersey area, you know, musicians, you know, poets, etc. Went to a very nice Greek restaurant in New York City, and a good time was had by all.
Excellent. And how long have you been living in New Jersey now?
Well, I suppose, well, in New Jersey, it's been about 7 years. But it's slightly false to say I live in New Jersey. I'm in the UK all the time, and increasingly in the UK. The UK feels like home these days. And I'm very happy to be there more. And I think my allegiances will switch a bit over to the European side of the pond, if I'm able to do that. I mean, I love to work in America, but, you know, I think I relax more in the UK. And I walk more. I mean, I love to walk. And where I live right now, you have to get in a car in order to walk, which I don't really.
Yeah.
And I love London's public transport. It's just absolutely wonderful.
Do you think if you move back here permanently, your songwriting will change as a consequence of not having that exile's eye on Britain?
It might change. Well, we'll see. If Trump gets back in, I might just up sticks, you know, and move back. We'll see how it pans out. Yeah, but you know, but being in America, I mean, I lived in California for a long time, 30 years in California, and I never felt that I absorbed much of the local music scene. So that was, yeah, real perspective there. So, you know, I'm living the classic exile's existence of, you know, I open my computer onto The Guardian and there's, you know, three fish and chip shops in Santa Monica and you know, eight pubs and 100,000 Brits, you know, living in Santa Monica, you know, but mostly working in the sort of film industry. You know, an exile among equals in that sense. But I think I think I keep the same perspective. I think my perspective is a bit it's a bit Brontian or something. You know, I carry this kind of Wuthering Heights landscape around inside me for some reason. You know, I kind of place characters into a very British landscape. Be it Brontian or just plain old suburban. You know. I just think that's who I am, and it's inescapable.
That reminds me, actually, have you seen that Fairport is still for sale, as far as I can tell? It's been on the market for over a year, as far as I can tell.
Well, when it dips below 50,000, I'll put in an offer.
Yeah, it's a way to go, I think it's fair
to say. It's expensive, isn't it? It's like 6 million or something?
Yeah, really expensive. Yeah.
I think it's come down a bit, but yeah, it is quite pricey.
But it was always a big house. When we were rehearsing there, and some of us were living there, it was, yeah, the downstairs was the doctor's surgery and waiting rooms. So we didn't have access to that part of it. But you put the whole thing together. I mean, it's a big, God knows how many bedrooms. It must be like 6-7 bedrooms. You know, large Edwardian thing, edifice. You're listening to the Mojo Record Club.
The record you've brought in to talk about today is from the American side of the pond. It's the Watson family, a.k.a. the Doc Watson family. First released on the Folkways label in 1963. Before we talk about it, let's play a track from the record. This is Your Long Journey, written by A.D. Watson and Rosalie Watson, and released on Folkway Records in
1963. And as the angels come and call for you, the pangs of grief forget my heart.
So, Richard, the first maybe an obvious question is, can you tell us how and when you would have first discovered this record?
Well, when I moved in with Simon Nicol in 1967 into the bohemian capital of London, Brent, which is, you know, handy for the Brent Cross flyover. And eventually, the Brent shopping centre. So there's myself and Simon, and then Ian joined us. And it was kind of in the house. I can't even remember if it was my record, Simon's record, or whose record it was, or if we just borrowed it off someone and never gave it back, which is a very common practice in the days of vinyl. So it was just in the house, and there it was. And it got played a lot, actually. And for me, it was a bridge. From what I knew of British music, British traditional music, into the Appalachians and then into country music, etc. But it was this kind of missing part, which later led me to explore old-timey music, to then listen to Clarence Ashley and people from, you know, the Carolinas and Tennessee, you know, the Appalachian Mountains, the Smoky Mountains. This really important link musically. I think Beyonce is going there on her new album as well. So it's all incredibly current. But first of all, it's a very ear-catching record in so many ways. And you can't get away from the fact that Doc Watson was an amazing singer, an incredible guitar player, and a pretty good banjo player, and a pretty good harmonica player. Doc Watson, of course, was blind. And yeah, he could tell you the time of day, but by the pitch of the crickets,
wow,
outside. He also he as a blind man, he rewired his house. I mean, that's the most terrifying thing I've ever heard. But apparently, the wires feel different. You could have fooled me, but he rewired his house. What a guy!
That's incredible. Did you how much about British folk did you know at the time? Were you in a position to be able to draw those affinities between the Appalachian tradition and the British tradition in 67?
Well, to some extent, I think we got more knowledgeable by sort of 69, when we were taking it on much more as a project and researching and saying this is something we really should be concentrating on. 67, you know, I'd hung out in folk clubs. I'd seen the Waltersons. I'd seen Martin Carthy. So I'd seen more of the revivalist side of things. I actually had a couple of Folkways records. When I was growing up, my sister had a great record called The Jug of Punch, which had Shirley Collins on it, Robin Hall and Jimmy McGregor were on it, Sean Ennis was on it. And it was a real introduction for me to these strains of traditional music. As a kid, I listened to a lot of Scottish music, voluntarily or not. I mean, it was just in the background all the time, especially dance music, Jimmy Shan kind of stuff. So, yes, I wasn't fully armed and fully knowledgeable, but by 67, I kind of had a rough idea of what was British and the overlap, on the Watson family album. There's The House Carpenter, which is originally a British song, and to listen to the Appalachian update is extraordinary. You hear this kind of bridge. There are some songs that disappeared from Britain in the sung tradition. They just weren't sung anymore, and yet in the Smoky Mountains they were still singing them, There's a famous example, a song about events leading up to the Battle of Agincourt. That's that 14-something. Henry V, I should say. And, it's about the King of France, instead of sending his tribute to the King of England, which he was supposed to do, sends him a barrel of tennis balls. And when we think of tennis as a modern game, it's a very old game. You know, it's 500-600 years old or older. And the King of England rightly sees this as an insult. So he invades France and there's the Battle of Agincourt. And people have stopped singing this in Britain. But a version was collected in the 1930s in the Smoky Mountains. But people were still singing about courtly matters. You know, Henry V, you know, 600 years later or something. I mean, it was just ridiculous. So I think the isolation of the Appalachians and the Smoky Mountains helped to preserve that link between Britain and America. And when people emigrated from, you know, somewhere like Norfolk, you know, they kind of take Norfolk traditions with them into the mountains, and you know, they get married with the same traditions. You know, that they'd have Christmas with the same traditions. The things really got preserved, and because these communities are so isolated, there was less outside influence. In the case of Doc Watson, you know, he'd listen to the radio, so he'd hear the Grand Ole Opry, and he'd pick up on some of the hits of the day, and he loved to play a song like Tennessee Stud, which was a hit for Tennessee Ernie Ford. But he knew all the traditional stuff as well. He was an extraordinary fountain of knowledge in that way.
You've cited Doc Watson as an influence on your particular style of acoustic playing. To an ignoramus like myself, can you explain what are the points of similarity between the two of you, or what you would have drawn from Doc Watson and what elements would have fed into your own style?
I think in terms of technique, I'm not so sure. In terms of musicality, I think I took a lot from Doc Watson. He had two styles of playing. He had flat picking, where you're using a plectrum and you're picking out individual notes. And he was a very, very skilled, adept flat picker who influenced a lot of people down the line, a lot of those kind of flashy bluegrass guitar players. Are influenced directly by Doc Watson. He also had a finger style, which I think he used finger picks for on a song like "The Train That Carried My Girl from Town" on this record. You hear his finger style, which is also beautiful. I mean, just exquisite.
We should probably hear a little bit of that. This is "The Train That Carried My Girl from Town," written by A.D. Watson and released on Folkway Records in 1963.
Where were you when the train left town? I stand on the corner with my head hung down. Hey, that train carried my girl from town. Hey, 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 hey.
But for that, you know, he'd be influenced probably by people like Merle Travis, a more commercial guitar player that would be having hits at the time. So he was really mixing it up. He was being contemporary, and he's hearing contemporary music on the radio. But he's also part of a big family, a big musical family, that sing hymns together and play music together generally. And he's a real bridge between the past and the present.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people might look to this music as having kind of, or want to seek out or find in it, to use a kind of a word in quotes, authenticity. Mm-hmm. And yet, as you describe it, it's anything but, because it's drawing in so many different elements from different places. It's just, you know, it is, you know, kind of the as you say, he's listening to the radio, he's drawing on kind of folk traditions, but he's also kind of hearing what would have then been popular music and kind of playing them all together. Yeah, if you come in ignorance to it, you might not hear that. You might just hear this kind of music that sounds authentic and ancient.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that just means that he absorbed things in an authentic way. So he knew the tradition. And he just add to it. And like a lot of traditional singers. I mean, traditional singers in the UK. I'm trying to think of who I actually heard. Elizabeth Stewart, who was one of the younger members of the Stewart family, a great family of traditional singers and song collectors. Lucy Stewart was the sort of the grandmother who everybody collected songs from. And Elizabeth was, I think, a granddaughter. And I heard her sing a few times. She'd sing local songs, you know, bothy ballads, which are probably only at the time, you know, probably written in the 1920s. Then she'd sing like the big ballads, you know, the really old songs that could be 400 or 500 years old. And then she'd sing something off the charts, you know, without really blinking. You know, she just liked a good song. Or what she considered to be a good song. And she didn't discriminate. And I think it's only when people like Ewan McColl came along and had a kind of a code, you know, this is how you sing a traditional song. You know, you have to sit backwards on a chair with your hand over your ear and sing it in this dramatic way. You know, Ewan was into drama. You know, he came out of theater. The things became so codified and so precious. And I think it's good to have people like that. I think it's good to have people who will preserve what they see as the purity of the tradition at that time in history. But of course, every 10 years that changes anyway. But it's good to have people who are doing what they think is the pure thing. And then have everybody else do what they like with the song. If you want to do a jazz version of Matty Groves, great, fantastic. If you want to do a ska version, brilliant, wonderful. It doesn't really matter as far as I'm concerned. A song is a song. A good song is a good song. And you can do what you like with it, in a sense. And if something becomes really popular that you do, you know, it's a song like Tom Dooley by the Kingston Trio. You know, another song that comes out of the Appalachians about a murder. I think, again, it was in the 1920s. That's a song that was a top five hit in America. But it's a very traditional-based song. And you know, sometimes that whole world will kind of peek up and say, look at me, I'm a traditional song, but I'm in the charts. You know, it just happens sometimes. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
It's also, it can be quite a dangerous thing as well. The obsessive pursuit of cultural purity can be quite. I read this very interesting book on this subject a few years ago. I just looked up the title because it's a bit long-winded, but it's called "Faking It: The Quest for Authenticity in Popular Music."
Ooh.
By Yuval Taylor and Hugh Barker, and it's really, really good on this subject because it really identifies the actual truth about people like Leadbelly. Basically, that you know, we want to see Leadbelly or a lot of the musicologists who praised and rediscovered Leadbelly wanted to see him purely as a singer in a very austere cultural tradition.
Yeah.
But most of Leadbelly's actual live repertoire was the hits of the day, was the tunes of the day that, of course, the Lomaxes or whoever didn't want him to be anywhere near because it soiled their perception of him as this authentic voice of the past.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, very interesting point, yeah. Of course, you know, in the 1950s, I mentioned Ewan McColl, but you had clubs in the UK, folk clubs, where you couldn't bring an instrument in. You know, even the Watersons in their own folk club couldn't bring in a guitar to play some of the songs that they'd written. So that there's kind of a puritanical streak there. As you say, I mean, people really should be singing what they think of it are good songs. And if that song is hundreds of years old, great. If it's written last week, fantastic. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
I suppose the inevitable question at the end of this conversation is, can you recall that kind of what happened when you put out Legion Leaf? What kind of response did you get from that community when they first heard it?
Well, it was divided. We had real champions. A.L. Lloyd thought it was great, thought it was the most exciting thing he'd heard for in a long time. That was wonderful. Cyril Tawney really loved it. You know, and there were the naysayers as well, who thought it was just, you know, including Ewan McColl, who thought it was just a travesty and a waste of time. Ian Campbell didn't like it either. I mean, you know, so it was kind of backwards and forwards. I think with us that was fine. I think we were expecting it to be that way. I think we were expecting a bit of controversy, and we were gladdened to have a few champions from, you know, the folk world, respected figures in the folk world. And obviously it didn't stop us. You know, we kept going in a certain direction. And you know, I still feel myself kind of in the same direction, really. I'm writing contemporary songs, but the tradition is still the main base of what I do. And I think that's important. You're listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Richard Thompson.
Going back to Doc Watson, he was a guitarist who I think said of his own style of guitar playing, he tried to tell a musical story within his playing. Mm. And that seems to be something very much you've adopted, or that's something that is kind of in tune with, I think, the way you play. I remember you saying to me that when you're playing instrumentally, you've got nothing to hide. In a way, it's your most autobiographical means of expression, because it's kind of like you emotionally express most what you want to say.
I think that, yeah, I think, well, I hope I've absorbed some of that from Doc. You do hear someone when he's playing, totally immersed in the music. There are no distractions there. I mean, he's just absolutely inside it. Perhaps the blindness helps you to shut out distractions in that way. I don't know, but he certainly made the most of his disability as a musician. I think the way he played, his attitude to music, is something just inspiring. It should be inspiring to everybody who hears him. Extraordinary man.
There's definitely you can, if you want to, kind of attribute the uniqueness of his style to an acuteness of hearing, you know, that, because obviously he developed an acuteness of hearing because of his blindness, and, you know, and kind of, and so I think, and you would probably agree that guitarists need to hear better than the rest of us, as well as just merely play well, that there isn't a kind of there's something in the playing that is about the acuteness of hearing.
Yeah. Well, people talk a lot about, you know, the zone, you know, oh, he's in the zone, he's not in the zone. It's very confusing and abstract term, really. But there are times when you feel that the music is almost playing by itself, that you stepped aside and you're just flying. And those are the best feelings that I think you have as a musician, where the music just takes over and you are, well, I like the word conduit. Yeah, you feel like you're a conduit for the music. That it's flying through you, rather than I'm a genius. It's coming out of my extraordinary brain. My brain is actually, you know, stepped aside for a moment and is allowing things to happen. It's just allowing the music to almost be itself without interruption. And all you're doing, all your being is almost like an overseer. Mm. As it's going on, yeah, you're almost like you're in it, but you're not in it, and you're kind of watching it for almost as an outsider, as the music flows through and it plays itself. But as the overseer, you have to. You have to remember that, you know, you've only got 8 bars, or you know, there's something that tells you that F chord coming up, you know, boom. Look out for that tricky diminished chord. Okay, but, you know, there's this other part that kind of it puts a logical grid over the abstraction and the intuition and the subconscious activity. Phew.
You were in the zone there, Richard.
I was. I was in the zone talking about the zone. So there you go. Doesn't get better than that.
I'm guessing, but I might be wrong, that you would have met Doc. Did you ever meet Doc Watson?
I never met him. I saw him play a couple of times. The best I was in Kilburn. I think, was it an Odeon in Kilburn? I think so. one of the big old cinemas, and Plangsty were opening. I mean, of all things, yeah, Plangsty opening for Doc Watson. My God, you know. So Plangsty, like, brilliant. And then Doc Watson comes on with his son Merle, and then they were just absolutely wonderful. And Doc was so he had that American thing. There's a Brit, you know, I'd be a bit more cynical about, but he knew everybody's name. He knew the name of the sound guy. He knew the name of the stage manager. He knew the guy who ran the theatre. Like, he mentioned everybody's name. He's just such a sweet man. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's brilliant. And was he, what year would that have been?
Well, that's a good question. It was in the 70s somewhere. I think Plangsty were just, they were either breaking up or they just broken up. So it was like one more show, you know, before that they went their separate ways. But it was just, what are those great evenings I'd like to rerun, you know?
Yeah, amazing.
What about any of his contemporaries? Did you meet any of those other kind of, that era of Appalachian musicians? Did you come across them or play with them?
I don't think so. I mean, I love Clarence Ashley, but I think he was older than Doc, and I think he was more recording probably earlier. I think when the Revivalists found him, he was probably in his 70s. But he was extraordinary. He's another extraordinary link with all that stuff. You know, the playing, it's incredible kind of modal banjo with a suspended fourth note in the scale, where harking back to again to Great Britain. In its kind of unresolvedness, you know. I can't think who else was still around when I was in America anyway. You know, I probably saw more blues singers because blues singers became very popular in Britain and in Europe, actually. So they'd come over quite a lot. So it'd be like Howlin' Wolf, Reverend Gary Davis, Champion Jack Dupree, you know, they'd all be, you know, touring in the UK, and you could see them a lot. And there was the blues and gospel train, which was actually televised, whenever that was, 63 or something.
Sister Rosetta, and
such an extraordinary thing. I think Muddy Waters was on that as well.
Yeah, and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee,
McGee, spectacular. And I saw some of those people. Again, at various times and places, but you know, the old timey musicians, I can't think.
They didn't have over here. They didn't have that immediate impact that the blues musicians did they? There wasn't that obvious reflection into popular music in the way that blues had that impact on British bands.
Yeah, I mean, the blues thing in Britain was huge in the 60s. And you had some, you know, pretty good practitioners, so, you know, like Cyril Davis, you know, Alexis Corner, these people who were helped to popularize the blues for a British audience. And so the groundwork was kind of done. So when, you know, Sonny Boy Williamson or someone came over, you know, he's got a ready-made backing band in the Yardbirds or something. So it was an easier step for them heading for Europe. And they probably found it less racist in Europe as well, you know, that actually to play for this whole other audience. I mean, in Chicago, they'd be playing in little clubs, you know, the little dives to not very big audiences, actually.
And playing for mixed audiences as well in Europe.
They probably found that, you know, intimidating and extraordinary. There you go.
One thing that I didn't realize about Doc Watson was that he was nowhere near as old as I thought he was. Bizarrely, it's like when I was researching this, he was only 40 when he made this record. He sounds like this ancient patriarch on the record, but he's barely a middle-aged man by today's standards.
Yeah, true. And he had an extraordinary voice. I mean, he had the maturity in his voice of someone who could be 70, you know, you just had no idea. Just a really rich, deep tone of voice, and a fantastic singer, wonderful singer. One of the greats.
We should go out with another track, and I think you should choose it, Richard. What track would you pick off the album to sort of play as the last track?
What song I'm fond of? Perhaps Darling Corey. Is that what it's called? I think that's what it's called, yeah.
Yeah, why that one?
Again, I think it's a beautiful synthesis of kind of the old and the new. There are so many elements in there. You know, there's elements of old European music. There's great singing and playing. It's a good story. You know, the last time I seen Darling Corey, she was sitting by the banks of the sea with a 44 strapped around her and a banjo on her knee. I mean, that's good stuff. You know,
it is. And it's like, yeah, and that runs deep, doesn't it? That in your own music as well, that need to tell the story and that need to put in that kind of, you know, the telling detail.
Yeah, the detail is everything. It makes for it makes the song visual. You know, you can kind of picture it. You know, and it's kind of funny as well. You know, it's kind of quirky. I think even for Doc, it would be a kind of a slightly humorous line. You know, to sing
The wit is important as well.
Yeah.
Excellent. So this is Darling Corey, written by A.D. Watson and released on Folkway Records in 1963. Richard, thank you so much. That was absolutely brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Pleasure for me too. Thank you so much.
Okay, you have been listening to Richard Thompson, John Mulvey, and myself, Andrew Mayle. That was the Mojo Record Club. We hope to see you at the next one. And look in the episode description for full details of all the tracks we played. And don't forget to like and subscribe. It would be hugely appreciated.
And don't forget to listen to the bonus episode with this month's record reviews from myself and John.
You've been listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Richard Thompson. Thompson, 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 Thompson. Thank you for listening, 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 for listening.
Electronically rechanneled to simulate stereophony.